All right, I just scrawled out on the overhead projector, well, not on the overhead projector, but on a thing that goes on the overhead projector, a couple of quotes, and I'll put them up. When I was a first-year student at Theological College, I worked with a minister who found this all very new technology, and he hadn't quite caught the lingo. So he used to say, when he was preaching, "Excuse me for a second while I just throw up on the overhead projector." He used to say it all the time. No one had the heart to tell him. That didn't quite translate. But anyway, I'm just going to throw up on the overhead projector. If I was to say to you that people believe more in knowledge they discover themselves than in knowledge that is presented to them by others, would you agree with me or would you disagree with me? I agree. What if I mentioned to you that learning is more effective when it's an active process rather than when it's a passive one? Would you agree? Now, I mentioned in the session this morning the old Mrs. Bayfield, who used to come in and fill the board up with words and we had to copy them down. Let me indicate to you that I have been a school teacher, used to be a school teacher, and there are some things that, you know, just quite literally are best learned by rote. There's no question about that. So I don't want to overstate the case here. Let's be aware that there are areas of learning where just the sheer old commitment to rote learning material is possibly one of the better ways to incorporate it. But generally speaking, I would hold very strongly to a view that said people are more than likely to incorporate and use and embrace knowledge that they have discovered for themselves than knowledge that is presented to them by others. I would be very committed to the view that learning is much more effective when it's an active process on the part of the learner than a passive one. This is probably a discovery that the educational arm of society discovered back in the 40s and 50s. By the time it had seeped down into universities and schools, certainly in this country, we're talking about probably the late 60s, but particularly the 70s, and now well and truly it was entrenched into the 80s and the 90s. And that is that children just don't learn just by writing down great volumes of information. I have got books of material that I wrote at school, enormous scads of information that I just had to write down and learn. My Bachelor of Arts degree, my Bachelor of Theology degree, basically I walked into big rooms and sat in tiered seating while someone stood at the front and did what? Exactly what I'm doing to you. Talked at me at great length. I had to write those words down, memorise them, and I was examined on them. Now, what the educational institutions discovered was that that's just not the most effective way for people to learn. People learn when they are actively involved in processes. People learn when they have to struggle with it, explore it, push it, press it, bully it, cajole it, see if it translates, incorporate it. The whole action-reflection model is much more now fully embraced as the way in which people learn or discover new information. There's only one institution, schools, business, the works have all embraced this, but there is still one institution that still believes the best way to pass on new knowledge is to have people sit quietly in an entirely passive process while great volumes of information sort of vomit forth over them. And what institution is that? That's us. That's the church. And not only in church, not only in terms of sermons and preaching, but in the way in which we do evangelism, we have developed a mindset for evangelism that invites the one being evangelized to be almost entirely passive in the process, while the one who is doing the evangelism is the active one. We should know all the answers. We should have a clear understanding of the gospel. We should do all the work. Now, I had actually become, pardon me, a Christian by the time I was at Sydney University. Not long a Christian. I grew up in a nominal Catholic family and made a commitment my last year of high school. One that I struggled with enormously, but certainly in my first and second years of university, I can remember evangelical students coming over to me while I was sitting on the lawn at Sydney University and saying to me, "Excuse me, I'm from the Evangelical Union or from the Christian Fellowship or from an AFES group, whatever it happened to be. I'm wondering if I could take a few moments of your time to present to you what we believe in." Now, I have only two options open to me. In other words, I can say one of two things at this particular point. What are those two things? Yes, I'm interested. No, I'm not interested. And they're usually articulated in much more colourful language, I should indicate to you. But presume that I'm prepared to buy into this and I say, yes, sure, go ahead. They would then sit down with me, and because I had actually become a Christian and was still sort of struggling with this whole idea of faith and evangelism, what it was all about, I kind of had some sort of strange voyeuristic enjoyment of being evangelized, even though I was already a Christian. Have you ever let someone present the gospel to you, even though you're a Christian, thinking, oh, yeah, let's see how you go, come on. So these guys would sit down with me and they would pull out a tract and they would basically take me through something like this. There's a big cliff over here. There's another big cliff over there. You are on this cliff. God is on that cliff. You've tried lots of ways to get from your cliff across to his cliff, to bridge this chasm. Is this ringing any bells for any of you guys? Good works, prayers, blah, 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 other religions. None of it's worked. You're still separated by this enormous gulf between you and God. But God has made a way. The bridge from this cliff to that cliff is the? Consensus? The cross. So the cross is laid across here. This is the way to God. Now, after that's presented to me, they would then say to me, I mean, it could have been the four spiritual laws, two ways to live, there was a whole stack of them. After this had been presented to me, and I don't object to the content in any of those presentations I just mentioned, but after this had been presented to me, I then had one of two options available to me at the end of that process. When they then said to me, there's a prayer here on the back page. Would you like to pray this prayer? Would you like to sign this prayer as indicating a commitment that you would like to make? I basically had one of two options available to me at this point. Funnily enough, they were the same options that were available to me at the beginning of the process. And what are those two options? Yes, I buy it. No, I don't buy it. Now, I've actually caricatured campus evangelism. I recognise that. And I also recognise that people do get saved through cold turkey event-style presentation of the gospel. So don't for a minute imagine that I'm writing it off completely. But my concern here is, was there any activity on my part other than listening? Was there any expectation on me other than listening, watching, understanding, and choosing? Basically, I'm not engaged in the struggle with the issues. I'm not engaged in having to be actively involved. I'm not being asked to discover anything for myself. I'm simply being presented with a model that I have one of two choices, that is either to accept or to reject. Now, given some of the material that we looked at this morning in terms of looking at postmodernism, increasingly, I believe, efforts to evangelise people that invite them to be entirely passive in the process will become increasingly less effective as the days go on. Would you agree with me? But what we need to rediscover is the extraordinary and intriguing way in which the Gospels invite us to consider the possibility of evangelising, although that term wasn't used in the Gospels, but evangelising in ways that invite people to be actively involved in the process. Whenever Jesus was seeking to present people who are not yet part of his community of faith, I'm not talking about his teaching of the disciples or his teaching of the broader Christ community, the gathered ones that were surrounding him. It's hard to work out how many of those and what structure they had. I'm not talking about his teaching of the faithful or the believers, but whenever he was impacting or seeking to make an impact on those who had not yet begun to embrace the kingdom, what was his chief mechanism for presenting truth to them? It was the parables or the stories, as some of you mentioned. Now, parables, you ask any Christian this, and you usually get the wrong answer. Parables were designed to do what? That is, to take lofty, philosophical, theological truth about the kingdom and to present it in simple, understandable ways that related to and were drawn out of circumstances and situations that people could understand. Right? I'm afraid not. That's the way most people would understand it. That parables, the same way we use illustrations in preaching, are supposed to make truths easier to understand, simpler to embrace. Unfortunately, we've actually got a bit of a clue for us from Jesus as to what parables were really all about. You see, Jesus tells the parable of the sower. Now, just between you and me, I happen to think the parable of the sower and the seed is one of the easier ones to understand, don't you? I mean, there are some doozies there, aren't there? But like the parable of the sower and the seed, I mean, that's generally speaking not a difficult one to embrace. But after he tells it, the disciples come to him and they say, huh? They say, why do you use these parables? I mean, just between you and me, Jesus, it ain't working because no one knows what you're talking about. And then Jesus says to them, listen, the reason that I use parables is in order to make it more difficult for people to understand. What's going on? I use parables in order to make it more difficult for people to understand. In a sense, I use parables to veil something of what I want to say. I'm not going to make it so plain and so clear. Why? I think it was because Jesus was profoundly aware of the kind of response a parable invites. Imagine that you are a group of people listening to Jesus' parables. Jesus tells the parable of the prodigal son. Probably the one parable that really articulates, if you like, the gospel in one fell swoop. There are going to be a number of responses to that. There are going to be some of you who are going to listen to this parable who are going to say, huh? What did he say? I don't know, he's talking about some guy, his son blows all the dough, he comes back home, his father welcomes him. I don't know what he's talking about. And they would drift away. And it seems as though Jesus was quite prepared for parables to have that amount of effect on people's lives. Because he also knew that some people were going to say, huh? What did he say? Something about a guy, he blows the inheritance, he has to go back home, his father forgives him. Gee, I don't know what that's all about. I'll have to have a good hard think about that. And then Jesus also knew that there was a third category, perhaps the smallest, I'm not sure, but yet a third category of people who would say, huh? It's intriguing. Someone who would blow all his father's or half his inheritance, come to his senses and return to a father who would forgive him. What does that all mean? I think I'm going to have to go and ask. See, I believe the parables were designed by Jesus to actually work out which of those of the group here are wanting to actually deal with the issues. Which ones want to explore? Which ones want to go on the search? Which ones want to struggle with the truth? Be actively involved. See, Jesus doesn't use the parables simply to spew forth the gospel and make everything clear to everybody so they can all go off home and decide whether they're going to make commitments or not. Jesus actually uses parables, if you like, to sort the sheep out from the goats, to use another allusion from parables, but you understand what I'm saying? Jesus actually uses the parables to find out which of you are on the money. You can imagine him almost telling parables to groups of people and watching that guy's eyes are alight. I've got to talk to you a bit later on. And look at her, she's crying. She must be really impacted. Come and talk to me. And these guys here are nodding away and chatting. They come and talk to me. Recognising that there are going to be handfuls, scads. Goodness knows how many people who are going to listen to these stories, not know what they mean, not care what they mean, not want to explore that. And Jesus was quite prepared for that to be the case. Are you following what I'm saying? The parables are actually designed to be hooks, to be tags, to find out which of those of you who are listening to these stories are wanting to pursue the truth further. In Matthew chapter 7, he actually says, ask and you shall, seek and you shall, knock. In other words, let me throw out a parable out there and see which ones of you want to ask. Which ones of you are going to knock? Which ones of you want to do some seeking and searching? The parables were actually designed to get people involved in an active process. If Jesus simply presents the gospel, you are on this cliff. God is on that cliff. You can't get to God, but one day you'll understand this. I'll die on the cross, and the cross bridges the gap. What happens to searching in the lives of those who are listening? What's left to search for? What's left to explore? What's left to be actively involved in? Too much of what we do in evangelism actually sucks all the searching, all the seeking, all the engagement out of the process. Would you agree with me? The only response you've got is yes, I agree, or no, I don't. There's nowhere left to go in the process. Churches, I believe, have got to start to build in systematic ways, but it also ought to start to affect our preaching as well, presentation of truth, inviting people to struggle, to seek, to knock, to ask, to be engaged in the process. One of the most daring occasions when this happened was in John chapter 8, where a woman is brought to him in adultery. Are you familiar with this story? Only women usually were charged with adultery. I could never work that one out. adultery must have meant something different in those days. And you actually had to be caught in the act by two or three witnesses, according to Hebrew law. So can you imagine the humiliation of this process? You are literally drawn or dragged out of your lover's bed by the two or three self-righteous witnesses who've observed the act going on, thrown into the street, and therefore on the testimony of two or three witnesses of good standing, you have been caught in the act of adultery. The law says that you must die because you are a sinner. And so now we can, it's almost like mob rule, we can take boulders and we can crush your skull. We're not talking about the life of Brian throwing pebbles at them lower. We're talking about literally caving somebody's head in with boulders. This woman is dragged out of her lover's bed. This woman is thrown naked or half naked into the dust of the street. She listens to two or three men of so-called good repute indicate that they've seen her in the act. She's guilty. We've got the law. We've got God. We're doing everything by the book. Let's go ahead. Until some smart aleck says, and this is one of the most despicable aspects of this whole story, somebody thinks to themselves, wait a minute, boys. Jesus is down at the temple and he does this forgiveness, grace, new life kind of routine. I mean, how far can you go? I mean, she's as guilty as sin. We've got the two or three witnesses, we've got the law, we've got God, we're doing everything right, just as God would have us do it, aren't we? So, I mean, Jesus would have to admit that grace and forgiveness can only go so far. Let's take her down there and see what he would do with her. Now, can you imagine the humiliation, the terror of being under the condemnation of death, only to be used as an object lesson to prove a few points against Jesus? What has happened to this person? She is no longer a human being in their sight, is she? She's dragged through the streets and thrown in the dust before Jesus, and they say to him, two or three witnesses, the law, the God, everything, we're doing it all by the book, we're all self-righteous, we've all got everything worked out. I mean, how would you deal with this? And Jesus' response is uncanny and extraordinarily risky. Jesus says to them, I guess you're right. I mean, that's what the law says. It's what God says. It's what the church or the synagogue, the temple, that's what the teachers of the law would say. Good on you, boys. You're doing it all by the book. I guess carry on. But before you do, I mean, we might as well do this with some semblance of order here. You'll start throwing stones. Someone could get hurt. Why doesn't the one who's never sinned, you throw the first stone, and then the rest of us, we can all line up behind you? And then John actually notices that at that point, Jesus does what? He squats in the dirt and doodles in the sand. Now, if you've read the end of John's Gospel, he actually says, mate, I only told you the best things that happened. I mean, if I were to put everything down, there wouldn't be enough books to actually contain it all. Which is a bit of hyperbole on John's part, but we'll allow it, okay? I mean, there's just not enough books. I mean, there's so many stories I left out. I couldn't tell everything. I mean, I just had to tell the very best stuff. So if John is so concerned with space, as classically editors are, if he's only picking and choosing the very best, I ask myself when I read John chapter 8, why? Why did you have to waste just those few lines, that little bit of extra ink, that little bit of paper, to actually tell me that at this point Jesus squats in the sand and doodles in the dust? I think the answer is here, that John had spotted something quite key in the process. It's almost as if, by squatting in the dust, by doodling in the sand, there's a sense in which what Jesus is doing is distancing himself from the process. It's almost as if he's saying, hey, listen, I'll give you a little bit of truth. Whichever of you is without sin, you can cast the first stone. Just a little bit. It's not the whole gospel. It's not all you need to know, but there's a little bit of it. It's as if he throws it out to this angry mob filled with self-righteous justice and says, chew on that. And then by squatting in the sand and doodling in the dust, it's like he's saying, work it out. While all around him, all he can hear is the thud, 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 thud of one stone after another hitting the deck. And when he looks up over this sea of stones, I'll finish the story because it's so good. He says, is there not one who would condemn you? This woman is under a death penalty. Can you imagine her barely getting words out? No, she says, not one. And then he says, then? Neither do I. Go and... You've only actually really got the right to say no and go and sin no more once you've said, neither do I condemn you. Don't you agree? What would we do? Under the same circumstances, what would we do? When they bring her to us and throw her in the dust, because we know the whole gospel, and because we're so concerned about everything so simple and clear, what would we say? We would say, you self-righteous hypocrites! Don't you know that nobody is without sin? We've all fallen short of the glory of God. Repent and confess your sin and recognize that we're all equally fallen. And the way to come to Jesus is to recognize you're on this cliff, God's on that cliff. Cross the whole routine. We would feel duty-bound to present the whole damn thing. What does Jesus do? Jesus takes an aspect of it and lets them be actively involved in the process of working it through. Do you understand what I'm saying? We want to tell the whole thing all at once, make it clear and simple, no questions, no searching, no seeking, no struggle, no sleeves rolled up, no activity on the part of the learner. Just sit there and listen. You have all sinned. None of you have the right to condemn this woman. But Jesus actually trusts them to work it out. Do you trust people that much? Do you trust God that much? Do you trust people and God that much? The genuine seekers, genuine searchers might just find God if we help them in the process of being actively involved. Reminds me of the story of John Wesley's missionary trip to America. You know this story, don't you? Any Wesleyans here? No. Well, let me tell you this story. I'm a Baptist. What am I telling you this story for? You know John Wesley, one of the worst missionaries the world has ever seen, right? Absolutely dreadful. An absolute disaster. He comes to Christ in England. He's studying God's Word. He's just marinated in the Scriptures. He's committed to holiness, to giving to the poor. He's playing it all by the book. He knows the Word. He's committed to holiness, and he's committed to meeting the needs of the poor. He gets on a boat and he goes to the Americas to preach the gospel. He's a man filled with doubt and uncertainty, afraid of whether he's really accepted in God's sight. And just between you and me, those kinds make pretty poor missionaries, right? You might know it up here, that there's something missing here, just doesn't kind of connect. Am I right? Well, it's certainly right in his case. Poor old John Wesley was an absolute disaster. On the boat, on the way back, bemoaning the fact that even though he knows the Word backwards, he can't make it work. He's filled like a hollow man with doubt and uncertainty. Does God love me? Has God accepted me? Is God's hand on me? When the big storm blows up, the ship is pitching and tossing. Looks like all hands are about to go down with the ship. And just between you and me, if you're not certain that God's hand is on you, not good to be on a ship in the middle of a storm either, okay? When he looks across and he sees a bunch of Moravian Christians doing what? Singing. Praising. Filled with serenity. And he races over to them and he says, what have you got? I haven't got what you got. I mean, I'm so filled with doubt and uncertainty and anxiety. I mean, what have you got? Look at you people. You probably don't know the Word as well as I do. You probably haven't given as much money as I have to the poor. You're probably not as committed to living like Christ as I do. But I don't have this centered, grounded sense of serenity. I mean, what have you got? Give me what you've got. And the famous answer in church history is that they say, oh, it's quite simple. Just get on your knees. We'll put our hands on you, pray for you, fall over. You have this funny sensation. You laugh a lot and everything's fine.
Amen.
Well, I'm sorry to tell you that wasn't quite the answer. Maybe it went like this one. Well, the problem is you haven't been baptized by immersion. So what we need to do is to take you through a 6-week course. We'll train you in what baptism's all about. We'll immerse you, invite your family. You'll come up out of the water. You just feel whole and refreshed and new and centered and serene. Well, I'm afraid it wasn't that answer either. I know what your problem is. You haven't been taking communion every Sunday for the last goodness knows how long. So what we need to do is invite you into the feasting community. You have to be... Well, there's none of these answers, my friends. It is one of the most famous answers in church history. An answer that actually changed the face of Christianity. These simple Moravian Christians don't offer any solutions, any answers, any formulas. They simply turn to this man and they say, go home, John Wesley, and search for God. go home, John Wesley, and search for God. Does it sound like much of an answer to you? He went home and he searched. He asked, he sought, he knocked. It happened to be, in his case, only months later, though some of you might have spent years searching for God. But in John Wesley's economy of time, it was only months later. He was in a Bible study with Moravian Christians and they were reading Martin Luther's commentary on Romans, something that I read regularly. In German and Latin, of course. They're reading Martin Luther's commentary on Romans and they come to Romans chapter 3. You know this part of the story, don't you? That as he was reading these verses, he says, it occurred to me, as if for the first time, that Christ died for me. I mean, up until that point, I knew Christ died for me. But it was at this point that I believed that Christ died for me. Do you remember that time in your life? And surely you're aware of his words. He says, at this point in time, my heart was strangely warmed. Which is a very English way of saying, with respect to our English visitors here. In his very restrained British way, his heart was strangely warmed. Why? Not because some solution was offered him, not because some answer was poured all over him, not because someone else took responsibility for him, but because some very simple, wise, committed evangelists just said, this will work for you, John Wesley, if you go and search for God. My view on evangelism is this. We ought to perhaps be telling a bit less often and encouraging people on the search a bit more often. What we want to do is end the process before we've ever invited anyone into it at the beginning. What we need to recognise is that there are people in Australian culture today who are genuinely searching for a God. It's not a problem these days to openly discuss the notion of searching for religious faith. Have you discovered that? I would be on a plane probably fortnightly. Guys who are in ministry who are old enough to be my fathers regularly tell me that there's nothing worse than sitting on a plane or going to a dinner party or being somewhere where people, when they were my age, saying to you, oh, what do you do? And you say, I'm a Baptist minister, and the conversation ends and all the cutlery clangs on the table. You know what I find? I find when on aeroplanes, in pubs or clubs or dinner parties or whatever, people say to me, and what do you do, Michael? And I say, I used to kind of ease on into it. Oh, I work with the church. And we kind of let it unfold slowly. You know what I say now? I say, oh, I'm an ordained Baptist minister. I'm not so fussed about being ordained, but it just seems to be sort of for them. They just go, what? You're a what? Are you kidding? They ask, well, yes, they say, yeah, you look like every Baptist minister I've ever seen. They say that is, I mean, there's a torrent of questions. What's the church like? How's it going? Is it full of old people? What are they doing these days? Is it growing? Is it declining? Is it happening? What do you think about this? What do you think about that? I mean, you're not pariah anymore if you're a minister. That's my experience anyway. You're actually now somebody who can be part of my quest. Now they'll ask the same thing to the Buddhist monk and to the Dalai Lama supporter and to the New Age reincarnation specialist. Well, they'll ask it to anybody. You're just now part of the smorgasbord, but you are no longer a closed option per se. People are searching. What we need to do is not to end the search by just dumping the whole gospel on them, but tease them along in the process. Churches need to learn skills in recognising what it's like to do what used to be called, and I think we should outlaw the term, but used to be called pre-evangelism. As far as I'm concerned, there is no such thing as pre-evangelism. The whole process is evangelism. We've got to start to think much more in terms of process and far less in terms of events. Or if we're into events, events that move people along the process. Now let me pause at this particular point and invite any responses, questions or comments. How do you respond to this so far? Yeah. I think the question was, for the purpose of the tape, what do I think of Christianity explained in the context of what we've just been saying? And so far as it's a six-week process, and so far as you're inviting people into some learning, it's not bad. It's not as good as it could be, I don't think. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Alpha. Have any of you come across Alpha? Well, from Britain you certainly would have, but I know a couple of guys. I know Rod's been to an Alpha training course. Alpha kind of expands the notion, goes over a longer period of time, involves the use of meals, weekends away. It's the same kind of notion. It's a journeying, processing group, but takes more seriously the idea of process. It also happens to take more seriously the impact of the Holy Spirit in that process than does Christianity Explained, but also the idea of community and reflection and weekends away, like action, engagement. In that respect, they're quite useful tools. Some of the most effective evangelism I've done has been a road less travelled discussion group. Any of you familiar? I know it's very old now, the road less travelled. You all familiar with the road less travelled? Scott Peck. It was a 78, 79 it came out. Since 1978 or 79, it has been on the New York bestseller top 20 list continuously. It is a phenomenon of publishing. An extraordinary book. But, I mean, it's now getting a bit old hat, I must admit. But what we found, particularly back in the 80s, was that your average searcher, your average seeker, may not have been ready to step right up to the plate for Christianity Explained. That's anticipating some significant degree of interest, isn't it? But The Road Less Travelled, which deals with what love is, what grace is, what relationships are like, which actually explores, certainly not at a Christian level, but it actually invites people into processes of exploring how this works. I found that as, again, I'm going to use a term I'm not comfortable with, as a pre-evangelistic step in, we did a 12-week course on The Road Less Travelled and we couldn't keep people away. Are you familiar with Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus? I mean, come on, I don't even think it's all that great, quite frankly. But in terms of issues of exploring how men and women interact in their worlds, how they see things differently, the whole issue of relationships, of grace, of treating each other with respect and dignity, can't you work your way through that to the gospel? Not hard, is it? It's about finding some of the languages and the longings, some of the current issues of search and inquiry, and starting to Christianise them, and then perhaps next step up might be Christianity Explained or Alpha or something of a similar nature. It's about being prepared to do some of the pre-thinking and consider that not as pre, but as part of the general process. Anything else? People invariably say to me, well, doesn't a time come when you just got to just say it? Well, the answer to that is yes, of course it does. I'm not suggesting if someone's saying to you, how should I be saved? You should say, just journey with me a little longer, my friend. I'm not suggesting that for a minute. What I'm suggesting is that, you know, you will know the degree to which a person is prepared to go through the journeying process. It's part of us being sensitive to the needs of people and personalities and their particular stage in that process. Some people can come at things very quickly, some will need this teased out over an extended period of time. I found this in Time magazine recently. It's a testimony. Did you see Time magazine earlier this year where they did this special on, the cover article was on healing, spiritual healing? Deepak Chopra, are you familiar with him? You should be familiar with him. He's like, he is it as far as kind of new age self-help, health, religion, psychology mix is going these days. He was kind of featured fairly heavily. But in the middle of it, you know how they do the little box, the little testimony sort of bit in any kind of major article? Here's the box. It's actually a testimony of somebody's conversion. It's not a Christian conversion. Would you like to hear some of the language that they use? It's extraordinary. It sort of set the hairs up on the back of my neck. It's written by a guy called Marty Kaplan. I don't know who he is other than a former speechwriter for Vice President Walter Mondale and Hollywood studio executive. He's a screenwriter and a producer. And in a country where politics and entertainment collide so neatly, he seems to be right in the nexus. Listen to his testimony. it was tooth grinding that got me to God. Yes, tooth grinding. I didn't know I was on a spiritual path at the time. I couldn't face the prospect of wearing a night guard to protect my teeth from stress. And the alternative I stumbled onto was meditation, which I'd read about in a Deepak Chopra book. Please go to Dimmicks and Angus and Robertson's, go to the Self-Help New Age section, grab Deepak Chopra. I mean, that is in Queensland of all places, surely. The people are into this. So just put your finger on the pulse. I got more from mind-body medicine than I bargained for. I got religion. And here's his testimony. I'm the last guy you'd figure would go spiritual on you. To be sure, I started out as a nice Jewish boy from Newark, New Jersey. But with puberty, well, that came doubt. I became the Voltaire of Shiloh Avenue, the scourge of poor old Rabbi Engel, who endured my contempt for his gullibility. By the time I graduated from high school, I was a budding molecular biologist, and though I continued fasting on Yom Kippur, it had become an act of solidarity with my heritage, not an obedience to a God I believed in. He then goes to talk about his time at Harvard, how he increasingly slips away from his religious heritage and ends up basically an agnostic. Some people might manage to find purpose despite this, that is, despite his atheism. Making from earthly values a sufficient basis for moral choice and meaningful life. I mean, love, even if it can be reduced to psychological explanations, can still make the world go round, can't it? Even if I'm an atheist. Justice, even if its origin is political, still be legitimate, can't it? Beauty, even if its perception is hostage to the taste of local tribes, well, it can still move the spirit. That is where I thought I would spend my life, a cultural Jew, an agnostic, a closet nihilist. Now comes his conversion. Are you ready? Of course I didn't like it. Who wants to face death without God? Who wants to tell the kids that the universe is indifferent to them? But the alternative, faith, that was just unavailable to me. Once the mind thinks some thoughts, it cannot unthink them. What attracted me to meditation was its apparent religious neutrality. You don't have to believe in anything. All you have to do is do it. I had worried that reaping its benefits would require some faith that I could only fake. But I was happy to learn that 90% of meditation was just about showing up. It's religion with no strings attached. Sounds good, doesn't it? The spirituality of it ambushed me. This is the point. I thought it was just a simple process and there's no religion attached. But the spirituality of it ambushed me. Unwittingly, I was engaging in a practice that has been at the heart of religious mysticism for millenniums. Millennia, I think he means. To separate 20 minutes from the day with silence and intention is to worship, whether you call it that or not. To be awakened to the miracle of existence, to experience being, not only in roses and sunsets, but right now, as something not out there but in here, this is the road less travelled, the path of the pilgrim, the quest. The God I have found is common to Moses and Muhammad, to Buddha and Jesus. It's known to every mystic tradition. In mine, it's the Tetragrammaton, the name so holy only those who know it dare not say it. It's what the Kabbalah calls a yin, nothingness, no thingness. It is spirit, it is being, it is all. I used to think of psychic phenomena as New Age flim-flam. I used to think of reincarnation as a myth. I used to think the soul was a metaphor. Now I know there is a God. My God. In here. Demanding not faith but experience. An inexhaustible wonder at the richness of this very moment. Now I know there is a consciousness that transcends science, a consciousness toward which our species is unsputteringly evolving. Are you going to tell me that there are people not searching out there? All he wants to do is to stop his grinding teeth, and he ends up religious. He doesn't end up Christian, does he? I don't know what kind of religion he has. Just a classic amalgam of a whole stack of different sort of bits and pieces. But the point that I'm wanting to make here is this. There are increasingly people out there who think the only thing that they want to solve in their life is their grinding teeth, their stress, who think they only just want to fix their marriage up or be better parents, but who in the process of being drawn into journeying begin to discover that they actually desire much, much more than that. Would you agree with me? And that what we need to do is to have some of the courage and the creativity to work the angles and to understand how best to move people through those processes. We did Women Are From Mars and Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus in small groups in our churches over and over and over. People would come just because they loved the book and they just wanted to explore it. You start to talk about relationships, you start to talk about love, you start to talk about grace. Where are you heading? Work it out. The numbers of times that we did presentations on The Road Less Travelled, Men Are From Mars, the number of times that we invited people into seminars on suicide prevention, on issues that people were concerned about, and moved them, not got them out under false pretenses so we could then hit them with the gospel in the last 10 minutes, but journeyed them through, what we discovered was that people are actually willing to do the work because they do dare to believe that beyond the material, there is some significant spiritual realities to be encountered. We need to be brave enough and creative enough to try to discover what some of those angles might be. In what ways have you been engaged in that kind of process? One time in church, we just showed over six Sunday nights, six episodes of The Simpsons. Got the big colour, you know, the three-colour back projection kind of thing. The Simpsons on big screen is quite overwhelming because of the colour. We got the classic ones, the ones where Homer meets God, where Bart goes to hell, where Lisa falls in love with a substitute teacher, Mr. Bergstrom. The one where Homer's stealing cable TV and Lisa goes to church, thou shalt not steal. We just ran six of them. And at the end of it, all we did at the end of each episode was talk for 5 minutes. Did you spot this scene? Did you understand that that scene could have meant such and such? And just teased people into the process of searching.